Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person, Text 33. Rajatas Chauratat Chatro Swajanat Pashupakshita Artibhyat Kalatat Swasman Nityam Parnatavadbhayam Rajatas Chauratat Chatro Swajanat Pashupakshita Artibhya Kalata Swasman Nityam Pranat Tavadbhayam Rajatas Chaurata Satro Swajana Pashupakshita Artibhya Kalata Swasman Nityam Pranat Tavadbhayam. Rajata,
Rajata,
from the government.
Chaurata,
from thieves and rogues.
Shatro,
from enemies.
Swajana,
from relatives.
Pashupakshita,
from animals and birds.
Artibhya,
from beggars and persons seeking charity.
Kalata,
from the time factor. Swasmat, as well as from oneself.
Nityam,
always. Prana archavat, for one who has life or money.
Bhayam,
fear. Translation. Those who are considered materially powerful and rich are always full of anxieties because of governmental laws, thieves and rogues, enemies, family members, animals, birds, persons seeking charity, the inevitable time factor, and even their own selves. Thus, they are invariably afraid. Purport. The word swasmat means from oneself. Because of attachment for money, the richest person is even afraid of himself. He fears that he may have locked his money in an unsafe manner or might have committed some mistake. Aside from the government and its income tax, and aside from thieves, even a rich man's own relatives are always thinking of how to take advantage of him and take away his money. Sometimes these relatives are described as swajanakadasyu, which means rogues and thieves in the guise of relatives. Therefore, there is no need to accumulate wealth or unnecessarily endeavor for more and more money. The real business of life is to ask, who am I? And to understand oneself. One should understand the position of a living entity in this material world and understand how to return home, back to Godhead. Om Agana Chimadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Sri Advaita Gadara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Who can escape from anxiety in this world? How is it possible? Just count the ways that people try to solve the problem of anxiety. Through money, they think that will stop the anxiety. Through relationships, they think that will stop the anxiety. Through intoxication, that will stop the anxiety. Through lots of sleep, they think then they'll be free from anxiety. None of these things work. How much practical vision does it take to see the obvious? But people don't understand the actual environment they're living in. They talk about ecology. They talk about environmentalism in terms of water and air, endangered species. They don't understand that the overall environment of the material world means a place of anxiety. As you know, the spiritual world is called Vaikuntha, where there is no anxiety. And the material world is called Kuntha, the place of anxiety. So why do you wonder that there's anxiety when you're in the place of anxiety? Just like if you're in the ocean, why do you wonder that you're wet? So what is the use in spending your whole life to escape anxiety through material methods when the very material world is a place of anxiety? So if you truly want to escape anxiety, then you have to get out of the material world. That can be done even in the present lifetime. It's not that you have to wait until this body drops before you can hope of attaining a situation free from anxiety. No. You can leave the material world even while being within this material world. Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga can do that. When your only thought is simply how to give pleasure to Krishna, then you're not in the material world. The material world is the place for those who want to satisfy their senses. The spiritual world is the place for those who want to satisfy Krishna's senses. So to begin your step into the spiritual world, all you have to do is at every moment ask, how is what I'm doing going to give pleasure to Krishna? That's all you have to do. Then you're in the spiritual world. Your first step is there. Don't take it to be a small thing. This is a common mistake by devotees, to consider it a very small thing. Is this the best thing for Krishna? But if in the core of your heart you're asking that question in a very sincere and humble way, that is the beginning of your spiritual, your residence in the spiritual world. It begins like that. So don't minimize such steps forward. Every moment of the day, you ask yourself, how is what I am doing or saying going to contribute to Krishna's pleasure? Is this the best thing that can be done for Krishna's pleasure? Or is this for my pleasure? But how can I do anything for my pleasure when I'm not independent? I'm part of Krishna. So if I simply do what's best for Krishna's pleasure, automatically I'll be included without having to worry about myself. This is all you have to do to make your first step in the spiritual world. And then over the years, as the years of your life in devotional service go by, if you keep it up, this mood will thicken. Eventually, it reaches the stage of bhava, preliminary love of God, and then prema. So you have to start somewhere. Just like, you know, every relationship begins somewhere. With a glance, with some words, something. And then things escalate from there. Similarly, your relationship with Krishna through service has to begin somewhere. So don't belittle the small steps you make in the beginning. They're so important. And Krishna's watching. Krishna's watching to see the development of this feeling in you, of dedication to his service for his pleasure. You keep that up as the years go by. Don't think that, oh, I did that when I was a young devotee. Now it's time for me. Sometimes older devotees have that problem. I've done for Krishna enough. Now it's my time. My time has come. I have given so much. I have sacrificed so much. Now what about me? No, don't allow that to happen to you. We want to combine the freshness and enthusiasm of young devotees with the maturity and wisdom of the older devotees. For the older devotees, every day should continue to be a day of discovery in Krishna's service. Discovering newer and newer things about Krishna, how to please Krishna, newer and newer things about how to relate better to Krishna's devotees. As you become an older devotee, you should be more expert in dealing with all different kinds of persons. It's very easy to insist that everyone should be like us. It's a very easy thing to do. It's actually impersonalism. As you become a mature devotee, you should become more expert in seeing how everyone is Krishna's part. And you try to act toward that part of Krishna in such a way that their Krishna consciousness is increased. Sometimes you have to draw the line. But still, there should be this appreciation of all different types of persons, because the variety all belongs to Krishna. That is the Supreme Absolute Truth. There are varieties, but they all form one unit, Krishna. Of course, Krishna is greater than the sum of the parts. Krishna has his own personality. The supreme whole is greater than the sum total of the parts. As we become more skillful in Krishna consciousness, we should be able to deal with all different kinds of persons. Not because we've taken a personality course, or not because we've specialized in psychology. Now, if someone has that background, that's nice, but the real reason for being able to handle different kinds of persons is because you recognize them as part of Krishna. And so Krishna gives you the intelligence. Based on your understanding, they're part of Krishna. The Lord reciprocates and gives you intelligence how to deal with so many different types of persons so that they advance in Krishna consciousness. So we should avoid the tendency to think, to try to stamp everyone into the same mold. At the same time, we have to, older devotees have to make sure that things go on nicely according to standards. There's nothing wrong with having standards. A place without standards is not a very, conducive place for becoming Krishna conscious. Krishna consciousness is all about standards. When there are the proper standards in place, then everyone knows what to expect and they can increase, they can raise themselves up. There's always pressure to bring down standards because this is the material world. Things always deteriorate. Krishna says that himself in Bhagavad Gita. Imam Vivashvate Yogam Proktavan Ahamavyam Vivaswam Anave Praha. Then, what's save? In the course of time, Krishna explained, that knowledge of parampara, it seems to get lost. Sakalinaha mahata yoganashta parantapa. It doesn't mean that Bhagavad Gita becomes lost. It means that due to the effect of time, a clear understanding of Bhagavad Gita becomes lost. That's the nature of the material world, due to the effects of time. So standards always have a way of becoming corroded because of the time factor. So you have to understand that. And you should not weary of constantly having to apply the standard and reapply the standard, introduce the standard, reintroduce the standard. It's just the way it is. Krishna does the same thing. Have you read in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, I'm tired of saying the same thing again and again. Have you read that? No. He says, I come again and again. Yada, yadharmasya. Whenever and wherever the standard starts to disappear, I come. Tadatmanam shrijam yaham. I manifest whenever things are going wrong. What does he tell Arjuna? I'm telling you the same thing that I spoke to Viraswan millions of years ago. I'm saying the same thing to you. In other words, I'm reviving the standard. Krishna doesn't say, I've said this before, why do I have to say it again? How long am I going to go on like this? How many yugas do I have to keep coming? Saying the same thing. But sometimes our older devotees, they get a little weary of saying the same thing again and again. You have to understand that's the way this world is. And out of compassion, you say the same thing again and again, just like Krishna does. Sometimes when I'm talking to persons about chanting, and I say, all right, make a gradual plan for increasing your chanting. Pick a number that you won't fall back on and do that for a while. Then what would you like to increase by 1 a week or 2 a week? Sometimes while I'm saying that, I say, how many times have I said this before? But it's a great honor to say that. It's a great privilege to be able to introduce someone to the chanting of the holy name. So let us hope that we can say that same thing millions of times a day. That would be very wonderful. You have to understand how subtle the material energy is to stop preaching. If you can get the older devotees to think that it's just the same thing all the time. Asking people to chant, asking people to get a book. Then that's a great victory for Maya. Sometimes Sankirtan devotees, they can run into this neurosis. Is this what I'm going to be doing all my life? Just saying, hi, how are you doing? Where are you coming from? Take a look at this. Everyone's been reading this book. There's a danger that you see it as repetitive. But actually you should be praying to Krishna. Oh, if I could just say this with full Krishna consciousness 24 hours a day. And then Krishna will allow you to see the spiritual world within your activities. You never hear Srila Prabhupada having said, how many times must I say that you're not the body? Now, sometimes he would say, I've said it so many times, but then he would say it again. I remember once at Rath Yatra in San Francisco, 75. So thousands of devotees there. Srila Prabhupada was on the stage giving a lecture. And for the umpteenth time, he began to give his example. I've said it so many times. You water the tree at the root. The hand takes the food, gives it to the mouth. It goes to the stomach and the whole body is energized. So that time when he said it, it hit me like a thunderbolt. Even though I'd heard it so many times. Similarly, you can read Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam again and again. And you just, each time it's like, how did I miss that? Or it's something I didn't see before. You just go deeper and deeper. That's why it's a very wonderful experience for devotees to read Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna book, Nectar Devotion, read them again and again, because you lose your material sense of, well, I've read this before. I know the contents. You thought you did, and then you read it again, and wow. It's a very good experience for devotees to have. They can keep on reading Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, over and over again, and they'll never get satiated. Then you start to understand what the spiritual platform is like. That's why I'm not so much into devotees like, you know, trying to read every book in the world in terms of Krishna consciousness, because they start just jumping from one book to another. They have to have the newest book about whatever. And they never develop a cohesive understanding of the philosophy that way, and they never get that experience that you can simply read Bhagavad Gita again and again, and each time will be new. That experience everyone should have. Then you'll see how you can be satisfied in Krishna consciousness. That's very important to develop the confidence. We were speaking about confidence yesterday. The confidence that you can be satisfied in Krishna consciousness. That comes from taste. You know, the taste is there. And sometimes when you're off, you know what to do to get the taste back. That's the confidence we're looking for. All these things consolidate your grip on the spiritual world, even from within the material world. That's very important. You don't have to wait, as we said, that you give up your body. Even now in this body, you can experience the spiritual world. And then you can give it to others. What about the world of Kuntha, the material world? What will stop anxiety? We enumerated some of the ways that people traditionally try to stop anxiety. They think getting money, that will stop all anxiety because I'll have power. When you have money, you can do anything. Or they think, let me have sense gratification. Let me lose myself in a girlfriend, boyfriend, in a partner, and then in the just diving into sense gratification, I'll forget all my anxieties. This is quite common. Men think about that in physiological terms. Women think about it in emotional terms. If I can just have an emotional explosion, then all the anxiety will go away. And the men think, if I can just have a physical explosion, then all anxiety will go away. Everyone's trying to get out of anxiety. So much so that they take it out on their partners, their friends, their relatives. It's like something you've got to undergo if you're someone's partner or friend or relative. You've got to undergo them sticking their anxieties on you. That's part of it all. Let us recognize how anxiety is an inherent part of this world. It plays a huge factor in everyone's life. Got to escape anxiety. No one likes anxiety. Most uncomfortable feeling. You can be physically comfortable, but if there's mental anxiety, oh, your life is just miserable. Therefore, when all else fails, and even if everything is successful, take intoxication. That will balance everything. It'll heighten your highs. It'll even out your lows. Intoxication is so important. Try to understand how people cannot tolerate anxiety. They'll do anything to avoid anxiety. This verse, spoken by the Python Man, particularly concentrates on acquiring wealth. That acquisition of wealth produces more anxiety because you're so attached to what you have. That's the nature of material attachment. It It brings its baggage of anxiety. When you're materially attached to someone, you get an anxiety. Do they really care about me? Is this relationship good? Am I getting all that I should be out of this relationship? Anxiety. Is the person thinking about someone else? 10 years from now, will the person think of someone else? It's an anxiety. And of course, possessing wealth brings so much anxiety. As stated here by the Python Man, not simply is the anxiety because of governmental laws, thieves, enemies, family members, animals, birds, person seeking charity, the time factor, but also your own self. You're afraid of making a huge mistake in your wealth. It's a very interesting point. It's quite true, of course. When you have so much money, then you're worried, oh no, I could make one wrong move and blow it all. Thinking of buying a house, oh no. Maybe I just make a horrible purchase, a wrong deal. Buy some farmland. Oh, maybe the land is lousy. I've just blown everything. So much anxiety. Even material psychologists understand this. They say that when you start to be in the acquisitive mood, you're running the risk of great regret because you put so much pressure on yourself. I've got to make the right choice. I've got to do the right thing, the right investment. I've got to get the right property, the right business deal. And then when inevitably there's some problem, you blame yourself so heavily that you can even go into clinical depression because you take it so seriously that you're not up to the standard of a proper investor, a proper business person, a proper handler of wealth. So you become clinically depressed. Of course, people are like that about relationships too. Some people can really blame themselves. Oh, what's wrong with me? My relationship fell apart. It's like one devotee hears their father was left by the mother suddenly after 25 years of marriage. He just thought it was routine. You know, everything's okay. You know, I'm going to work. She's going to work. There are 3 kids, you know. You're in your mid-40s. Then one day, out of the clear, the wife just says, I want a divorce. And the man is just totally shattered. I met him. He was a walking case of shattered nerves and anxiety. He was just shocked. He had no warning. Generally, according to psychological studies, men are the last ones to figure out that there's something wrong. They're always caught off guard. It's like out of the blue for them. I thought everything was okay, you know. And then one morning she just said she wants a divorce. Why? What's going on? The vast majority of men have no idea that there's some emotional dissatisfaction. They just think the routines of the house are going on nicely, you know. She's putting food on the table, you know. There's mechanical sense gratification going on regularly. You know, what's the problem? So this man, he was shattered. And then he has to think of his future. I'm pushing 50. Where's going to be my partner? I don't have a steady partner sense gratification anymore. I'm forced out to compete again at my age. It's a disadvantage, you know. I thought I had it in the bag, you know. Lifetime committed partner of, you know, able to bestow the rituals. I thought it was, job security. And then, gone. And so the man is left facing the reality. What am I going to do? Pushing 50 and no steady partner for sense gratification. Oh, no. Oh, I got to live alone. Am I supposed to go out and date again? Am I supposed to, do? I don't know how to do that. I just lost all my social skills. I just thought, she was going to stay with me all the life, and, I wouldn't have to, be considerate. I wouldn't have to be emotional. I wouldn't have to talk to her. Just, it just goes on, So, even in relationship having, not simply having wealth, but having relationships, there's this great danger of the anxiety becoming so great. When there's a loss, it leads to destructive regret and then clinical depression. You can't do anything. You can't get anything together. Just lament and lament and lament. We understand the whole problem. The root of the whole situation is material attachment. It's a great lesson if we can simply understand a simple rule. Whenever there's material attachment, there will be anxiety. There's no material attachment whatsoever that does not produce material anxiety. So as soon as you find that there's a material attachment, you should know anxiety is there, even though you may not see it right away. You see, you need to recognize that the conditioned soul has this desire to just give himself away, give herself away, and in that giving, there won't be anxiety. You're meant to give yourself to Krishna. Then indeed there's no anxiety. But rebelling against Krishna, we seek to give ourselves to this one, give ourselves to that one, give ourselves to a nation, give ourselves to a political cause, give ourselves to be a sports fan or something. It's like here in New Zealand. I don't know if it's still like that. But, if the All Blacks lose, the whole country goes into depression. Is it still like that? No. Or it's getting less and less. Huh? Right. Yeah. And when they're doing well, everyone's elated, because of material attachment. And there must be anxiety as long as there's material attachment. If you don't want anxiety in your life, don't have material attachment. But you have to be attached to something. There's the catch. You cannot destroy attachment. Attachment is the symptom of consciousness. As long as you're a conscious entity, you must have attachment. So, bhakti yoga means to become attached to Krishna. You become attached to Krishna by becoming attached to Krishna's service. And when you do that service, you're thinking, what is the best thing that I can do for Krishna now? Is this the best thing for Krishna's pleasure? You get the strength to carry on in that consciousness by chanting the holy name with attention. Try to chant with attention every day. Don't think the effort will be in vain. We've said so many times, if someone made the effort to hear you carefully every day, you would think nicely of that person. So certainly Krishna notices if you're trying to chant and hear his name daily. He notices that. Don't think it's hopeless. Oh, my mind is so wild. Oh, I think it's always going to be like this. No, you will make gradual progress. You may not be a wealthy person, but still you can see in your own life how there's so many thieves around you in various guises. Of course, the Bhagavatam explains how in a traditional family, which doesn't exist that much, the man comes home from work and the wife and children surround him and, we need to buy this, we need to buy that. And the man feels a sense of, he's a provider, he's a maintainer, and he starts giving out the money, And he actually feels a sense of importance from that. He doesn't think he's actually being plundered. I remember Krishna Loka telling me about watching her sister. whenever her sister wanted something from her husband, you know, some new furniture or something, she would, you know, treat him very nicely, you know. Dear, how are you feeling today? And and then sooner or later, the punchline would come, you know. Don't we need a new such and such? A newer washing machine or another time-saving gadget? Do you remember you told me that? Huh? I don't forget these things. It was only about maybe 8 years ago. So, the husband doesn't understand he's being plundered. But because there's love, there's affection, I'm feeling important. Yes, how much would you like? It's being robbed. It's a vision that the Bhagavatam gives. It's not that the Bhagavatam is decrying parents who execute their family responsibilities. You have to see it all in context. It's just pointing out that while you may well and good be executing your family responsibilities, just understand it. Look at it from another point of view, you're being plundered. We can't take these things in an extreme way. The Bhagavatam is not urging that grihasthas avoid their responsibilities. I don't want to be plundered. I'm not giving her any money. I'm not spending any on the kids. They're robbers. We have to understand these things with maturity. Then what about the inevitable time factor? See how that is taking everything away. You forget about time, but time does not forget about you. Time is the ultimate plunderer. Even beyond governmental laws, thieves and rogues and enemies. All these thieves of various types make you so afraid of making the wrong move. And because that fear is there, you seek relief from that fear and anxiety. You want to absorb yourself in something. When you say you want to have a good time, much of that desire to have a good time means you want to get rid of anxiety. We're explaining to some devotees this morning how an essential feature of relationships is that the husband has to become accustomed to the wife offloading anxiety on it. That's just part of the deal. You got to get, you know, the sweet looks and the sweet glances sometimes. But you also got to get the anxiety dumped on you, too. It's all part of the package. You have to take the whole package. Gradually, at least in Krishna-conscious relationships, you can understand that this is not the most important thing and you tolerate it. I was telling one young lady, that don't worry. Let me assure you, it takes at least 15 years for a man to be able to handle a wife offloading anxiety on it. It's impossible when they're in their 20s. They just can't understand it. I didn't do anything wrong. What do you give me such a hard time for? They get all rational about it. It takes like 15, 20 years before they understand this is nothing rational. It's a complete emotional reaction. And you just have to, you know, get into the drama. Some of our older householder couples, they know that. I won't mention names, but they know how, the husbands know how to, you know, deal with it. Oh, really? Oh. Is that so? Oh. I watch. In Auckland, And often I flushed. Oh, yes, what to do? That even the wife says, I know it's a drama, but still it makes me feel good. But you can't expect that for at least 15 years experience. Anxiety is such a powerful driving force. If you understand the Bhagavatam, you can understand that. Try to see how people are unconsciously doing anything to escape anxiety. And part of escaping anxiety is to dump it on someone who's near and dear to you. That just seems like a logical thing. At least to one species. Of course, the other species has its own way of dealing with anxiety. Drinking lots of beer, or burying your consciousness into a sports game or something like that, on television or something like that. If you can understand how everyone's trying to escape anxiety, then you can see clearly what happens in material existence. If you want to escape anxiety, you have to get out of the material world. And you get out of the material world through devotional service. That's why the simplest lifestyle you can live provides such an easy way to not have anxiety. The more simply you live, the least chance there is for anxiety, even though this is a world of anxiety. So someone who wants to avoid anxiety knows the art of how to live simply. But even if you just live simply, unless there's Krishna's service as a center of your life, you'll still be in anxiety, because that's the nature of the atmosphere you're residing in. If we can truly understand how just by possessing things in the wrong consciousness, you're overloading your life with anxiety, then we'll be able to live simply. I was just reading some stories that Sitapati sent about people who win the lottery. And just as this verse says, they suddenly become materially powerful and rich, yet their anxiety just multiplies. There was one recently, a few years ago, there was one man in Texas. He was a religious man, according to the Christian Protestant standard. He had a family, three teenage kids, and he was really struggling to make ends meet. He was getting laid off from jobs, and he had finally got a job just stocking shelves in an electrical store. What kind of job is that to support a wife and three kids? But he was doing the best he could. And he kept praying, "Oh Lord, help us, give us more prosperity." And while praying, of course, he wouldn't just pray. He would be proactive in the Kali Yuga sense. He would go buy lottery tickets. The Lord helps those who help themselves. So, every week he'd go buy lottery tickets, twice a week. And he would, he would use the birth dates of his children. It's just a whole attachment thing. Pick those numbers for his lottery. And one day, he's watching television about the lottery results. And he suddenly realizes, I hold the winning ticket. I'm the only holder of the winning number, or something like that, however lotteries work. He won the lottery for $35 million US dollars. That's probably about 50, 55 million Kiwi dollars. He won it. So, immediately, you know, he bought a brand new house, you know, bought houses for his relatives, gave a lot to the local preachers, to build new churches worth several million. But he prided himself on being a soft touch. And whoever wanted money, you know, he would give money to. That was his self-pride, that, he was very charitable, giving money away easily. Finally, he had no peace. People were coming all the time. Money, money. People would show up at his door claiming to be long-lost relatives. Oh, by the way, I'm your fifth cousin. Yeah, I'm in a desperate situation. Can you give money? He got so full of anxiety by that. So many people pressuring him for money. He couldn't have real relationships. Everyone was after him because of his money. What did he finally do? One day he just went upstairs in his flash big house, took off his clothes, put a shotgun to his chest, and blew himself away. This is less than 2 years after he won $35 million U.S. dollars. This just happened a few years ago. And then there was a huge battle in the family over the inheritance. The grandparents were battling his children, Some were saying he didn't commit suicide. He must have been killed by a family member to get the money and this and that. Although the police said it was suicide still, some family members had their doubts. And then there was a battle over, whatever money was left. Meanwhile, the government came and said, actually, he doesn't have enough money left to his name to pay the inheritance taxes. So he'd just given it all away just because he had that pride. I give charity to everyone, whoever wants. And he wanted to be known like that. And as a result, he got so much anxiety that he committed suicide. Less than 2 years after winning $35 million U.S. dollars, after struggling for so many years to support his family. When he went to claim the prize, he went with his family members, his lawyers, and he just said, I knew good things would happen to me. I knew the Lord would take note of me. I didn't know it was going to be this good, though. That's what he said when he claimed the money. Then, 3 days before he committed suicide, he told his financial advisor, winning this money was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Then there was another case. A guy even won even more money. This was in West Virginia a few years ago. A guy was like the only ticket holder for a jackpot worth $315 million U.S. dollars. It was all his. So, same thing. He spent money right and left, giving $4 million to this preacher to build a church. He established charities in every town and village of his state to give poor people clothes and food like that. He was always carrying lots of cash. He was robbed outside some adult nightclub. Someone broke into his SUV and stole $500,000. This is how much money he was keeping around, It's like, if you had $20 in your pocket, but he had $500,000, You don't think twice about keeping $20 in your car. If someone breaks in and takes $20, well. So he's $500,000 in the car, big deal. Someone breaks in. This is how his life was becoming. The apple of his eye was His granddaughter, his teenage granddaughter, he thought the world of her. And so naturally, when he won the lottery, he got her a brand new car. She had two desires as a teenager. She wanted a car, and she wanted to meet some famous hip-hop singer. So he arranged all that, you know. He gave her whatever she wanted. You know, within the space of a couple of years, this 16, 17-year-old girl had like five brand new cars, you know. Then his life started to fall apart. His wife wanted to end the marriage. Of course, ending the marriage means she's going to get some of the money. We've always quoted the feminist mantra, they say in Australia, when it's time to leave the man, don't get angry, just get everything. So, his family fell apart. His teenage granddaughter started getting into drugs. People in the neighborhood said she's the most bitter teenage girl they ever met, because she can't have any real relationships with anyone because everyone's after her money. You know, the boys are thinking, not only is this sense grab, but, there's a lot of money attached to this too. Everyone just wanted to use her for her money. So she was the most bitter kid. And finally, she overdosed on drugs. Her body was found wrapped up in a rug underneath some old car. Had been there for several weeks after she was missing. She's overdosed on drugs. And that shattered her grandfather. He was like just almost deranged. This is within 2 years of having won $315 million U.S. dollars. And then his wife, she told the newspaper reporters, if I had known that all this anxiety and distress would have come by winning the lottery, I would have torn the ticket up. So, this shows you what's going on. Money does not translate into reducing anxiety. In fact, money, not used in Krishna's service, produces lamentation, produces anxiety. You can see that in Krishna Leela, the Shyam Tucka jewel affair. Very complicated. Yes, you've read in Krishna book. How did it start? What was his name? Satrajit or Shatajit, which is it? Shatajit, yes. He was friends with the sun god, Viraswan. He was a worshiper, but he was also a friend. So the sun god gave him a jewel locket that was effulgent like the sun and could produce 80 pounds of gold per day. So he put that locket on and walked into Dwarka to impress everyone. And so all the Dwarkavasis, the residents of Dwarka, they thought, the sun god is coming to visit Lord Krishna, because in Dwarka all the residents were accustomed to great demigods coming to visit Krishna. So they just assumed, here's the sun god Surya, he's coming to visit Krishna. They even went and told Krishna. Krishna was in his palace playing with dice. As we explained before, when the Supreme Personality of Godhead gambles, it's very interesting because Krishna never loses. Still, he's playing the role of a Kshatriya who can gamble. A warrior prince can gamble, so Krishna's throwing dice. And the residents of Dwarka come and tell him, the sun god is here to see you. Krishna just kind of smiled after listening to their praises, because they caught Krishna's attention by chanting his names, calling Damodar, Govinda. Then he told them, now, this is just an ordinary human being, it's not the sun god. So, Satyajit didn't even come to see Krishna. He was so enamored by his possession of this jewel, this Shyamantaka jewel, that he didn't visit Krishna, and he established a temple in Dwarka, put the jewel on an altar, and arranged for brahmanas to worship the jewel. And this way, you know, every day the jewel was supplying 80 pounds of gold. It was so effulgent. Eventually Krishna asked for the jewel. Not for himself, he said. Ugrasen is the king of kings. He's the emperor of all dynasties. The best should be given to the emperor. Krishna didn't ask for himself because Krishna knew if he refuses, it'll be a huge offense. Better I ask in the name of the emperor. In any case, Satyajit refused. No. Wasn't going to do it. He was attached to the possession of wealth. He was even ignoring Krishna, would not fulfill Krishna's request to give it to Ugrasen. So then his brother Prasena, Satyajit's brother Prasena, decided to show off. He took the jewel, the locket, and put it around his neck, got on a horse and rode into the forest. He wanted to feel what it was like to have this jewel, extraordinary jewel on his neck and show off to all the citizens. And while he was in the forest, a lion attacked him and killed his horse and killed him. And then, Jambavan, known as Rikshiraj, he's the king of the gorilla-like human beings. Species. He came and with his bare hands he killed the lion and took the jewel. And then he went back into his underground cave, which led to his house. And he gave the jewel to his son. Why did he give such an extraordinarily valuable jewel to his son? Jambavan's a great devotee of Lord Ramchandra. He's a bhakta, so he's thinking, wealth, big deal, I'll just give it to my kid. He knows no jewel is going to satisfy him, so he's like, my boy, you know, I'm attached to my boy, I'll give the jewel to him, let him play with it. So, when Prasena didn't come back from the forest, the word spread throughout Dwarka by ill-motivated persons. Maybe Krishna killed Prasena to take the jewel. Maybe that's why he's disappeared. Satyajit was thinking like that. Krishna wanted the jewel, and now Prasena has disappeared. It all adds up. So in this way, Krishna was being defamed. You see, even in Dwarka, sometimes these misunderstandings are there. Sometimes our devotees get very upset when they're apparently defamed or there's some misunderstanding. These things happen because, well, that's the nature of life in this world. Of course, in Dwarka, this is a pastime. This is a leela. But still, it shows you that you have to tolerate these kind of situations. So, the word was spreading throughout Dwarka by those who talk cheaply. So, Krishna, in order to clear his name, decided to do something about it, to be proactive. So he went looking into the forest for Prasena to see what was going on. And first, he came upon the dead body of Prasena's horse, then the dead body of Prasena, then the dead body of the lion. Krishna was accompanied by some residents of Dwarka. It was like a fact-finding commission. And then Krishna could see that the path led to this hole in the ground. So Krishna told the other residents of Dwarka, you just wait, I'm going in. Even though it was quite a scary looking situation, you didn't know what was up ahead. So Krishna walked through the tunnel. And at the far end, he could see the bright jewel around the neck of Jambavan's son. So Krishna just came before the son, the little boy, and stood there as the Supreme Personality of God, indicating, I've come for the jewel. But the boy's nurse became frightened, not by the presence of Krishna, but just, maybe he's going to take the jewel. What will my master say? So she started crying in fear, and then Jambavan comes. And he's angry. Therefore, he can't immediately recognize that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though he's a devotee. He's angry. And so then he and Krishna begin to fight. Because Jambavan doesn't want to give up the jewel. And they fought for 28 straight days, day and night. First with weapons, then with tree trunks, with stones, then finally their bare fists, just pounding each other over the course of 28 straight days. No break for night. And then finally, Jambavan starts feeling so exhausted, like every muscle in his body is aching, he's becoming completely lifeless. And then he realizes, there's only one person who could defeat me. This must be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The fact is, by his fighting, he pleased the Lord, because the Lord wanted to enjoy fighting. The Acharyas point out that actually Krishna didn't enjoy so much in killing Kamsa or Chanura or Jarasandha. It wasn't so much of a challenge. But when he wanted a real challenge in fighting, he fought with his devotee. And in this way, also Jambavan's fighting abilities were satisfied and Krishna was satisfied. And once Krishna became pleased by Jambavan's fighting abilities, then he revealed that I'm the Supreme Personality of Godhead, your master. And Jambavan, of course, recognized, you must be that same Lord Ram. You must be my worshipful Lord Ramchandra in form of Krishna. So then Jambavan, very happily, awarded the Lord the jewel and his daughter, Jambavati. Let me give you the treasure of my life. My daughter is worth more to me than the jewel. So I'll give you the jewel, but I'll give you my real treasure. I'll give you my darling daughter, Jambavati. So Krishna emerged from the tunnel with the daughter and they married at Jambavan's house, and then he emerged from the tunnel with Jambavati and the Shyamantaka jewel. By that time, all the residents of Dwarka had gone back, because for 28 days they were waiting? No. After some days, they just panicked, and, what's happening? Maybe something, some ill has fallen upon Krishna, maybe, we don't know. They went back to Dwarka and told all the citizens, Krishna went into this tunnel, he didn't come out. Everyone is lamenting. They started worshiping Durga, begging her, please bring Krishna back. Yes, you can worship the demigods to ask for Krishna. The gopis in Vrindavan do that also. And just as they were offering their prayers to Durga, begging, bring Krishna back, Krishna appears with Jambavati and the jewel. So then, Krishna and King Ugrasen organize a big meeting, and there Krishna explains the whole story about what happened, how Prasrena was killed, and Jambavan took the jewel and gave it to his son, and like that. And this way Krishna cleared his own name. And then Krishna said to Shatrajit, here, you want the jewel? You can have it. And shamelessly, Shatrajit took the jewel. Okay, he hung his head. He was embarrassed because he had been in on all the rumors. Maybe Krishna killed my brother in order to get the jewel. And he had started all that hubbub. So Krishna just said, "Here, want the jewel? Take it." And hung his head and he took it. But he began to think, "I've made a great offense. How can I counteract this offense? Not only have I made a great offense, but I've done something politically stupid. The Yadus are very powerful. Very powerful leaders and warriors. They may get on my case. I've got to do something." So he decided to offer his daughter, what was her name? Satyabhama, and the jewel to Krishna. So Krishna accepted the daughter, Satyabhama. But he didn't accept the jewel because he could see the motivation of Satyaji, that Satyaji was so attached to that jewel, he didn't really want to give it. So Krishna just took the daughter and said, "You keep the jewel." So then, the complications get even worse. This is all about attachment to wealth and opulence, producing greed, producing envy, even producing death. Krishna and Balaram went to Hastinapur because the word was out that the Pandavas and Quinkuti had died in the house of lack that was set on fire. Krishna and Balaram, of course, knew it wasn't true, but still, to play the role of ordinary human beings, they went to Hastinapur to lament with the family. And then while they were there, there was a conspiracy to murder Satyajit. Akrura and Kritavarma, they approached one rogue named Shatadanva, and they told him, "This Satyajit's no good. He promised his daughter in marriage to so many men, and he kept changing his mind before he finally gave her to Krishna. He should share in the same fate as his brother Prasena." In other words, they are urging him to murder Satyaji. They didn't say it directly. They just said, "He should share the same fate as his brother, who was killed by a lion in the forest." So Shatadanva became... He was already envious because he wanted to marry Satyabhama. And so, it's a deep story why Akrura and Kritavarma, great devotees of the Lord, got involved in this intrigue. Some acharyas say it was because Akrura was cursed by the gopis from having taken Krishna out of Vrindavan, so therefore he got implicated in all this. And that Kritavarma was sullied by his association with Kamsa, before Kamsa was killed. Or else the acharyas say that Kritavarma and Akrura couldn't tolerate it that Satyaji had blasphemed Krishna, so they really wanted him to get his due. Anyway, in any case, they were involved. They incited Shatadamba. Yeah, do something about Satyaji. He should share the same fate as his brother. So what did Shatadanva do? While Krishna and Balaram were away in Hastinapur, Akrura and Kritavarma, they made sure they were agitating Shatadanva while Krishna and Balaram were away. So Shatadanva breaks into Satyajit's house and kills him while he's sleeping. Very abominable according to any standards, even today's low standards. Killing someone while they're sleeping is considered to be abominable. He did that. And his daughter was present because she was staying with her father because the husband was away. That's real culture. She's staying with her father because Krishna was in Hastinapur. So she's crying piteously while Shatadanva is killing her father in his sleep. So then, she didn't have the funeral ceremony right away. She put the body in oil to preserve it. And she went to Hastinapur to tell Krishna. Actually, the Acharyas point out that Satyabhauma really had not so much affection for her father because she knew he was an offender to Krishna. But she was hoping maybe Krishna will use his mystic power to bring him back to life. So she went to Hastinapur and she told Krishna. And then Krishna and Balaram begin to lament like ordinary human beings. Oh, my father-in-law has been killed. It's strange, Krishna imitating the ways of human beings. He got into lamentation. And then they went back to Dwarka with the purpose of catching Shatadanva and killing him. So that's what Krishna did. Shatadanva knew, they're coming after me. He had a horse, a special horse that could ride 800 miles in one day. So he jumped on that horse to escape. After 800 miles, that horse died of exhaustion. It was just too much. And then Shatadamba started running on foot because he knows Krishna's coming after him. And indeed, Krishna cut off his head with a disc. And then Krishna frisked his body looking for the jewel. Of course, actually Krishna knew that before Shatadamba fled Dwarka, he entrusted the jewel to Akrura. Not that he gave the Sharmajaga jewel to Akrura, but just like a thief asking someone to hold the stolen goods while he runs, he did that with Akrura. Still, Krishna's playing in the pastime, so he goes along with it. He searches the body, no jewel. So then Krishna enters Dwarka, and he tells his wife, okay, justice is done. I've killed Shatadamba. And then it was time to visit Akrura about the jewel. So Krishna lets Akrura know, you've got the jewel. These things are known. It's not that I want it for myself, but just to convince my brother Balaram, why don't you just show everyone you have the jewel and so everyone will stop talking. Actually, Akrura had left Dwarka with the jewel. He had gone to Kashi. And there he was engaged in worshipping the jewel and getting lots of gold and using it for Vedic yajnas. So then, you see what happened? The word, rumors had spread again about Krishna and Dwarka. That there was some kind of tiff between Krishna and Akrura. And that Akrura maybe was acting like a rival of Krishna. So Krishna arranged to bring Akrura back to Dwarka just to put a stop to the rumors. And then he told Akrura, as the super soul in the heart, I know your motives. I know you're not a thief. I know you're not greedy. I know you're not lusty. You're not trying to just possess wealth. He understood that Akrura actually was very angry at Shachaji for having offended Krishna. Krishna understood that. Although apparently maybe Akrura got a little attached to possessing the jewel. Apparently. It's hard to say. Akrura's dear devotee of the Lord. So anyway, Krishna said, so, I don't want the jewel. Just show it that you have it. To put a stop to all these rumors. So Akrura did that. And in this way, the jewel stayed in Dwarka. Very complicated pastime, revealing very dramatically and clearly all the complications and intricacies and intrigues that come when there's inordinate possession of wealth. Better to live simply. Just like these lottery winners realize too late. Can you imagine winning $35 million, U.S. dollars, and then saying, I wish it never happened. Within 2 years? Or winning $315 million and within 2 years your wife says, if I had known life was going to be like this on winning that money, I would have torn up the ticket. And then look at the Simon Tucker Jewel situation. It's Krishna Leela. All the intrigue, the gossip, the rumors, even about Krishna, just because of this great wealth was blowing everyone's minds. Whoever possessed it, they got a bit bedazzled. Even Jambavan wasn't directly attached to the jewel, but he was attached to his boy having the jewel. So he got angry when he saw that Krishna had taken the jewel from his son, or wanted the jewel from his son. So please remember all these things. How Shashajit was profiling, entering Dwarka, brilliant jewel on his neck. You couldn't even see him because of the effulgence. Everyone thought this must be the sun god. Then his brother, Prasena, takes the jewel, rides on a horse to show off. All this just because of wealth. So we should remember these things. Better to live simply and use your time for thinking of Krishna. If Krishna gives wealth, use it for Krishna's service. Any questions? Bhagavad Gita to teach you how to act in Krishna consciousness. You should be attached to serving Krishna nicely. We're not attached to our pleasure, but we're attached to Krishna's pleasure. We want Krishna to get the best, even though Krishna already has everything. So when you're cooking or you're cleaning, you're thinking, how can I do this best for Krishna's pleasure? When you're talking to someone to introduce them to Krishna consciousness, you're distributing a book, you're thinking, how can I better do this? That's the attachment. You're not attached so much to the service itself, you're attached to the person you're doing the service for. That's why we don't want to become attached to positions. We take whatever duties and responsibilities we have as a chance to serve Krishna, but we're not attached to the position or the title in of itself. We're attached to giving pleasure to Krishna. That is bhakti. That is real yoga. How to please Krishna as the only priority. Anytime, any place.
How do we stop spiritual attachment that transforms into attachment?
How do you
stop spiritual attachment transferring to material attachment?
Can you give an example? One has to be careful in associating with the deity and associating with the spiritual master, because you can. Familiarity can breed contempt. With that kind of association, you have to constantly pray to Krishna that you don't take it for granted and become familiar. It takes a constant mindful attitude. Mindful means prayerful attitude. To be close to the deity or be close to your spiritual master. Because your material senses can start taking everything in a familiar way. So it takes an effort. Everything takes an effort. What's wrong with having an effort? Making an effort. Laziness is the real symptom of Kali Yuga. Why do I have to make an effort? I'll just be the way I am, and so what? If you love, if you care, you make an effort. That is bhakti. Love and care. You're happy to make an effort to show love and care. Not that, oh, whatever. No questions, Murray? Our friend from Levin? Any questions? What are you thinking about more, those ill-fated lottery winners, or are you thinking about Krishna's pastime with the Shaiva Taka Jewel?
I was actually thinking about wild promise.
Your own what?
Wild promise.
Yeah? Why that? Why your old primary school? Just keep chanting Hare Krishna. Hare, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.